In our last two sessions, we have seen the split of United Israel into two kingdoms right after the death of the tyrant King Solomon. That happened in about 941 BC, according to my calculations. The northern kingdom has the largest portion of the population and the largest portion of the territory. And the name of the king over that area is Jeroboam. And in last session, we know that he decided to establish a new religious holiday with two religious sites that are supposed to be dedicated in honor of the Creator God, of He who is the God of Israel, who brought them out of Egypt. But in reality, he's setting up two golden calves or idols there. The southern kingdom is ruled over by Rehoboam, the eldest son of Solomon. And he has in his territory the city of Jerusalem and also the temple building. And so that is why Jeroboam of the northern kingdom decided to start his new religious system so that his people would not travel across the border to the south in order to worship at the temple. And that resulted in a mass exodus out of northern Israel by all the truly religious, in the sense of worshiping the true and living God at Jerusalem, from the northern kingdom. And that's recorded in 2 Chronicles chapter 11, starting at verse 13. It says, "The priests and the Levites who were in all Israel presented themselves to him," meaning King Rehoboam down in Jerusalem, "from all places where they lived. For the Levites left their common lands and their holdings and came to Judah and Jerusalem because Jeroboam and his sons cast them out from serving as priests of He who is. And he appointed his own priests for the high places, for the goat idols, for the calves that he'd made." So the northern kingdom is all on board with Jeroboam's alternate religious worship plan. Anybody that disagrees with it is kicked out of the kingdom. So pretty much all the Levites, all of the priests have left northern Israel and gone to Jerusalem to live there for the duration of this problem of abandoning the true faith. But they're not the only ones that leave. Verse 16 says, "Those who had set their hearts to seek He who is the God of Israel came after them from all the tribes of Israel to Jerusalem to sacrifice to He who is the God of their fathers." So a lot of the people in the northern tribes abandoned their homes, abandoned their farms, abandoned their businesses, and moved south of the border, because they don't want to be participants in this northern kingdom where God is being worshipped by idols. And it's not just that, they're also worshipping other gods and goddesses, apparently. So this is going to make a big true faith vacuum up in the northern kingdom, which is probably why the northern kingdom doesn't last nearly as long as the southern kingdom. It also means that the southern kingdom of Judah is not just simply made up of people from the tribe of Judah and from the tribe of Simon and from the tribe of Benjamin, but it has living inside its boundaries as refugees, people from all of the tribes of United Israel. They've left their allotted territory and just moved south of the border. Now they, verse 17 says, "strengthened the kingdom of Judah, and for 3 years they made Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, secure, for they walked for 3 years in the way of David and Solomon." So all these people leave probably in connection with right around last part of 941, going into the beginning of 940 BC. And so that means that the three-year period seems to run through right around 938 BC, that the southern kingdom is looked at as being the place where the true faith is being upheld and lived by the king. And that's why everybody is supporting Rehoboam at that time. Now let's talk a little bit about Rehoboam. We can get some more information from over in 1 Kings chapter 14, verse 21. We'll eventually go back to 1 Kings 14 and stay there for a while, but we're going to get back to Chronicles in just a second. So let me read to you verse 21 of 1 Kings 14. Now Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, reigned in Judah. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city that he who is had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel to put his name there. All right, so we know that Solomon was on the throne for 40 years. When he died, his son, Rehoboam, came to the throne at the age of 41, which means he must have been born the year previous to Solomon being declared the king of United Israel by his father David. Now, we've been talking that tradition seems to indicate that Solomon was about 15 when David made him king. So that would then tell us that he must have had his son Rehoboam when he was about 14 and may have actually been married when he was 13. And he is also, we find out, half Ammonite. Because the verse continues, his mother's name was Naamah the Ammonite. So we know that Solomon had been marrying all sorts of women once he became king. But here we discover that even before he became king, he was married by David to an Ammonite princess named Naamah. And that means that Rehoboam was raised not just simply to believe in the one and true living God, but also his mother would have been teaching him about the Ammonite gods and goddesses. And the worst of their gods was the one, the destroyer king, Molech Chemosh, whom they worshipped by getting drunk, getting pregnant, and then burning up the bodies of the last crop of children that were conceived by the means of this ceremony. And we know that one of the things that caused the downfall of Solomon was his worship of the Ammonite gods and goddesses. So that's tied in right here with Rehoboam's life for the last 41 years. So he is not fully committed to the one and true living God. Now back over in 2 Chronicles, we have details about his family as he has come to the throne and becomes the leader of the southern tribe of Judah. 2 Chronicles 11:18, Rehoboam took as wife Mahalath, the daughter of Jeremoth, the son of David. So he marries within the family. We see royal families do this a lot. It's to try to solidify their power. And then of Abihail, the daughter of Eliab, the son of Jesse. So again, another family member. And she bore him sons, Yeush, Shemariah, and Zaham. And after her, he took Maakah, the daughter of Absalom, who bore him Abiyah, Attai, Zizah, and Shalomit. So again, multiple marriages, but marriages within the family are the ones that we're focusing on. Rehoboam loved Maakah, the daughter of Absalom, above all his wives and concubines. He took 18 wives and 60 concubines and fathered 28 sons and 60 daughters. So again, he's following the path of his father Solomon in having multiple marriages to solidify his power base, his military might, and to also kind of make it plain that he is the direct descendant of David, and that this David is supposed to be the one that all kings are related to. And so he's even bending that family tree back in on itself. Now, verse 22 kind of sets up for a future story. Rehoboam appointed Abiya, the son of Maacah, as chief prince among his brothers, for he intended to make him king. And he dealt wisely and distributed some of his sons through all the districts of Judah and Benjamin in all the fortified cities, and he gave them abundant provisions and procured wives for them. So Abiya will be in the running for the throne later, because that's what Rehoboam wants. But he's making sure that his sons are scattered all over the place, that they're taking leadership roles, and that they got everything they need in order to control the country. Because remember, he had a scare right at the very beginning of the split. He thought he was going to recover the northern tribe territory for himself, but God's prophet said no. And so the armies wouldn't fight for Rehoboam to capture the northern territory. So Rehoboam sees the northern kingdom as a continual threat to his kingdom. So he wants to stay strong. At this point, I want us to go back to 1 Kings 14 again. Verse 22 starts telling us how things fell apart within that 4-year period that he was king over Judah. Remember, for the first 3 years, he's got people that are pouring in from the north that are supporting him because he's upholding the true faith. He's the one that has priests of Aaron and Levites that are serving in the temple. He has the temple itself, and he's having the regular ceremonies take place there in accordance with the law. He is a son of David. So for them, they believe he's the upholder of legitimacy until this starts happening. 1 Kings 14, 22. Judah did what was evil in the sight of He Who Is, and they provoked him to jealousy with their sins that they committed more than all their fathers had done. For they also built for themselves high places and pillars and Asherim on every high hill and under every green tree. Now that's a description of idolatry that we're seeing here. So Rehoboam, who is half Judean and half Ammonite, he eventually starts following the path of his father at the end of his life. Remember, Solomon was worshiping other gods and goddesses. And once Rehoboam starts doing this, it becomes a free-for-all for all Judeans to engage in such pagan practices. And that's what they do. They start building all of these non-authorized worship sites to gods and goddesses of the surrounding nations and of the Canaanites and of the Philistines and of the Phoenicians, and the Asherim that's mentioned here. This is the Queen of Heaven, who was the fertility goddess of the Canaanites. She was the consort or wife or sister wife of Baal, the thunder and lightning god of the Canaanites. And the way that she was worshipped had something to do with a tree. You set up either a living tree or perhaps a carved tree, like a totem pole, I suppose, and you worshipped her by means of that, because the tree connected heaven and earth. Verse 24, and there were also male cult prostitutes in the land. And they did according to all the abominations of the nations that he who is drove out from before the people of Israel. Male cult prostitutes are just like female cult prostitutes. Gives the worshiper, and I'm using that in air quotes, the chance to connect sexually with their god or goddess. Because supposedly the god or goddess inhabits the body of this prostitute. And so you're effectively having sex with your god or goddess. And you paid for the privilege of doing this. And so they're doing all that sort of garbage. And also engaging in the things of the Ammonites and the Moabites, where they're killing babies as a sacrifice to this fiery god. And so it's horrible. And God does exactly what he said he would do. If they abandon him, he will abandon them. At this point, the First Kings passage starts talking about the arrival of an invader king from Egypt. But I want to go back to our Second Chronicles passage, which ties it in very clearly to the sin of Rehoboam. So, 2 Chronicles chapter 12, verse 1 says, "When the rule of Rehoboam was established and he was strong," so the first 4 years or so, "he abandoned the law of he who is and all Israel with him." So Rehoboam behaved himself for as long as it took for those people to move south of the border and to acknowledge that he was the son of David and that he had the right to the throne and that Jerusalem was the capital city by right of law and that the temple was the place where everybody should be worshiping. And so once he gets all of that support, that's when he finally starts acting the way he wishes to and worshiping the gods and goddesses that he wishes to. And he allows then that to happen all the way down into Judean society. And that's where God decides to pull back the protections on the country and allow it to be invaded by Shishak. I want you to also keep in mind that there is a tie into the northern kingdom with the country of Egypt. Jeroboam had gone down and spent at least a couple of years in Egypt and was tied in with the Shishak Pharaoh reign. And so when he takes the throne in northern Israel, he becomes an ally of Egypt. And between them is the kingdom of Judah. And so this was probably an attempt by the Egyptian king to tie himself more tightly with his ally, Jeroboam, by crushing the leadership of the country of Judah. So this is what happened, verse 2. "In the fifth year of King Rehoboam," which I believe is 937 BC, "because they had been unfaithful to he who is," Shishak, the Egyptian way that this is usually represented is Shishak, "king of Egypt came up against Jerusalem with 1,200 chariots and 60,000 horsemen." So that's a lot. "And the people were without number who came with him from Egypt." And so that'd be the foot soldiers. So we've got a very large military force. The Egyptians had regularly marched into Canaan in order to control this land bridge toward Mesopotamia. So that's what he's doing here, is he's taking over, at least bringing into his control this region. And so it's Libyans That's part of the Egyptian Empire. The Ethiopians are listed here as well. And then between them is this thing referred to as Sukkim. And people have tried to sort out exactly who these folks are. According to the wording of the Septuagint, these are supposed to be the troglodytes. And that word appears elsewhere, apparently as a reference to the people who lived along the western coastline of the Red Sea. And they lived in these little wicker houses, these booth-y-type things. And so this seems to be an alliance of Egypt, Libya over on the west side of Egypt, the Sukkim over on the east side of Egypt, and the Ethiopians down on the south side of Egypt. And so Shashank brings his allied army in, and verse 4, he took the fortified cities of Judah and came as far as Jerusalem. You might remember that Rehoboam had fortified a whole bunch of cities on the south side of Judah as a protection against an approach to Jerusalem from that direction. Well, Shashank takes all that. Verse 5, then Shemaiah, the prophet, came to Rehoboam. Now, Shemaiah is the prophet who told the southern kingdom people 5 years ago, don't try to take the northern territory back. Leave it alone. God wants you to back off. So this is the same prophet coming forth again. He came to Rehoboam and to the princes of Judah who had gathered at Jerusalem because of Shashank, and said to them, thus says he who is, you abandoned me, so I have abandoned you to the hand of Shashank. And then the princes of Israel and the king humbled themselves and said, he who is righteous. So they are sorry that their sinful behavior in this first few years of the kingdom have brought them to this point. And apparently at least some of this is sincere enough that God responds. Verse 7, when he who is saw that they'd humbled themselves, the word of he who is came to Shemaiah. They have humbled themselves, I will not destroy them, but I will grant them some deliverance, and my wrath shall not be poured out on Jerusalem by the hand of Shashank. Nevertheless, they shall be servants to him, that they may know my service and the service of the kingdoms of the countries. So God basically says, I am not going to allow the Egyptians to totally wipe out the Judean kingdom, but they are going to give it a really thorough thrashing and take things away from them. Verse 9, so Shashank, king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem. He took away the treasures of the house of he who is and the treasures of the king's house. Now, remember, we are only a few decades past the building of the temple, the most expensive per square foot building ever built, and the building of the Solomonic Palace complex, probably the second most expensive building per square foot ever built. And they had lots of gold and silver and other precious items left over that Solomon just took all of that and put it in the treasuries of the temple and of the palace. Well, here comes Shashank and he takes at least a large portion of that away as tribute. Verse number 9 continues. He took everything, took away everything. He also took away the shields of gold that Solomon had made. Remember the big shields and then the quarter-sized shields that were hanging in the house of the Forest of Lebanon on the walls all around. And apparently they took those down and used them for special ceremonies. Well, when Shashank came, he saw those and wanted them for himself. So he took all of those golden shields. I think there were 500 of them total. Well, King Rehoboam made in their place shields of bronze and committed them to the hands of the officers of the guard who kept the door of the king's house. And as often as the king went into the house of he who is, the guard came and carried them and brought them back to the guard room. So that probably gives an indication what the original golden shields were used for when the king had a special ceremony that took him through the palace and up to the temple itself. So now bronze shields, which are similar in color, not exactly, but similar enough, these are now being used in place of the gold shields that were taken away. And then verse 12, and when he humbled himself, the wrath of he who is turned from him so as not to make a complete destruction. Moreover, conditions were good in Judah. So apparently things settled down after Pharaoh Sheshonq's invasion of Judah. And there's even an indication here, I think, that they clamped down on some of the bad worship that was happening, at least kind of drove it underground so that it was not happening out in the open anymore. And at this point, I'm going to tell you what we're going to have to do quite a bit in our study of the divided kingdom. Because the stories that are told are often told in complete sections about Northern Kingdom incidents or Southern Kingdom incidents, we don't get a good chronology meshing between the two. So what I'm going to have to do is bounce around a little bit in order for us to see where everything kind of falls in the chronology as it moves forward. And so just get yourselves all ready, get some markers in your Bibles so that you'll be able to move between even Kings and Chronicles, a couple of different sections. When we come back tomorrow, we're going to talk about the Northern Kingdom and Jeroboam's son.